Thank you very much, Berendesha, for all your kindness, especially for getting me the tea. And I want to thank Paul for inviting me and for running O'Vale. It's a fantastic venture. And the fact that it's still going on is a great testament to the person running it and to all of you. It's great to be back in Cork. I'm delighted to see Corkonian eloquence is alive and well, and tongue-twisting way. I'll start reading. I will begin with a poem about and in memory of my dear old friend Dermot Healy. A lift. Tell me, is it all atomized energies, or do the dead, as Baudelaire says, have bad hours? The world goes on wicked as before, or worse, whatever history says. Because of us, we like to think. I'm not so sure. Remember the time we set a decade of tunes in the car to pass the time on the way to Derry, you giving the first one, no stuttering allowed, me answering. I'd like one more chat as we cross the border, four packed in the back, faces solemn for the soldier. Questions about fiddling styles, the long poem, you were against it, where I stood on the Bowron, and always the clouds parted. And anything, statues, Soho strippers, homeless boys, a sinking cruise ship could appear there out of nothing like a flock of Maybirds, because that's how life is, pure magic. Very good. I might shut this a little bit because I can hear the fellows. Sorry, you can open it again for air when you're. Thank you. I'm going to read this for Paul because we were talking earlier about how the can you hear me?
Yeah.
We were talking earlier about how the country has turned into a nation of administrators. And I better watch what I say. Sometimes I wonder what the point of a lot of it is, let's put it that way. A friend of mine calls it the revenge of the point system. This is called my boss, Vashksh. Vashksh was a boss, invented or in reality, probably invented, by the Portuguese poet Fernando Pessoa. And any of you who know about Pessoa, who was around roughly at the time of Beckett and Joyce, and he wrote in a thing I'm very fond of myself, in heteronyms. In other words, he invented various personae and wrote in them, but he particularly and successfully wrote as four different people. The last I heard, they had counted something like 80, Pat, heteronyms over the lifetime. Now, that was quite common at the time. It was a game, being here tonight reminded me of a number of things, listening to the competition earlier. We don't do enough of a play in poetry, you know, play. And I was thinking of the Agal of Berthe, if you know it, in the Shannos tradition, in Irish, where people, it's a two-person, and sometimes it's macaronic, which is really, really fun when it's in two languages. And the convention is that one person doesn't know one of the languages, but most of us know the two. One of the games they did then was these, they invented these heteronyms and wrote as different people. The thing that Pessoa did, it's a very liberating thing as a poet, and I keep threatening to do it, write as something completely different from yourself. And because you get out of your own way if you do that. So it would also, because all of the writers on the continent tend to write for the newspapers and review as well, he would give bad reviews to his own book. One of them would trash the other one. Anyway, he had a boss. Each of us has a boss, vanity, fame, fear of madness. Some people work for failure all their lives. I prefer the tangible. So I work for Vashkash at the Arts Council, designing surveys shaped like Greek vases. They're always doing surveys. I'm going to read a couple of poems. I was in America in 2013 for about 6 months, where I worked hard and they paid me money, which was great. Novelty altogether, I can tell you. They also gave me a house. And I think we have Seamus Heaney to thank for that particular job, as far as I know, like many of them. So I'll read these two poems from that period. I was in outside Philadelphia in a university called Villanova, and I was fascinated by the landscape, which is, I like mountainous, I get very nervous if I'm in flat places. And this was flat. But luckily it had that great big river, the Delaware, and which is really big. And you'd look across at New Jersey when you were down in Philly itself. But I could not get an in to this landscape. Spain, yes, Portugal, yes, but this one, just New York, yes, San Francisco, yes, but not this one. And these were my attempts to come to terms, and I gradually realized it's because I can't hear the voice of the people whose place it was. So, natives. English is making strange again, contrary as a two-year-old silence. Irish sticks its tongue out in hard, necessary syllables that spit and hiss and consonants like shards of gneiss. English is not the tool for this, but English is what I have. This is no way to map this frozen place, the sharp light, cars like barges, the flat lean grant of William Penn's tamed share, rearing suddenly up 100 floors vertical, but mapping is not what I am at, not sap, sap, sapping, but naming. Where is the voice of the Indian? I hear it in the wind. Feel it flense the skin, strip the wires, buckle the ground under the asphalt. The howl of America grown distant. The tense ghosts and street corner faces. A fox cried last night outside the window for a mate, for food, for the native, for no. There's an echo, of course, there of Kieran Carson's The Irish for No, deliberately. The ghost chant. The idea of the Indian ghost chant and these ghost caravans going across the landscape I found very powerful in this particular place. What it is to be a people, and particularly at this particular time, this was pre-Trump, but it was coming. What it is to be a people that lived so lightly on the land, their own families named each of them for the simple traits they carried or would inherit as gifts upon becoming grown, to grow up young. What it must be to lose an entire continent to men who traded in baubles and lies, who flourished under false names, and then to see your trails cobwebbed in the moonlight, pale, crossed by ghost caravans. They were stitched between mountains across the river we call Delaware. Night raiders, ghost encampments. What I am hunting is the syllables of old names. I hear their echoes in the chant, electrifying the body, drumming, singing the wolf's story. And obviously there's a little bow to Whitman in the end of that as well. This is called A Singing Supper for Paul Muldoon because it was about a supper I had with Paul Muldoon. We went to this place called the White Dog Cafe, and any of you who know about Madame Blavatsky, beloved of Yeats, and the Rosicrucians and so on, this was indeed named after Madame Blavatsky, and the story goes that this white dog, well, you get it in the poem. It's in the University of, they're now a chain, I think, but there used to be only the one. Bagpipe music there was none at the White Dog Cafe, though a baby gave a fair imitation briefly. Someone said, get a gun, and stopped on mercy. Poetry dipped in and out among the charcuterie, and Madame Blavatsky, somewhat like Marion Moore in the picture on the menu, like a bat out of hell herself. Sorry, I can't compete with this fella.
Does anyone know how this window closes?
Oh, no, we're stuck, are we? Okay.
Wait a minute.
The
phone. Oh, but I can hear it.
Phone usually works.
Maybe it was a. It could be a latch.
No, don't worry. It's. We might break it. No, thanks. It's okay. It's okay. Poetry dipped in and out among the charcuterie.
Everyone keeps.
And Madame Blavatsky, somewhat like Marion Moore in the picture on the menu, like a bat out of hell herself. Off with her leg, the surgeon said, which is what surgeons do, and what can you expect? But the lady not for turning set off with you. My leg will not go to the spirit world before me, are you mad? And lay a white dog across it and was cured. Hogwash maybe, but this hog was clean and raised green and ended as excellent pork tureen. I swear it said, eat me, oh Alice. We named the dead first, then the living, inquired after trawlers and family and tennis, checked in on my Colin and the Moy and who had a book out every 10 minutes and who a film admiring me. Later I thought about Ireland, how we're better away than going back, mostly. But through the evening, what I wanted to say and didn't, between the word kind and the word likely, was about the French translator, who, unable to imagine anyone going to sightsee a roundabout, came out with the Ballygawley Carousel. I wanted someone to sing it, and how a few always attract the whirligig roustabout music to their poem, like Rambo, and others don't, or kill it. I'll read a couple of Sweeney's, and I want to read this for Pat Potter, whom I'm delighted to see here, a man who is a byword for poetry, not just in Cork, and for standards, and for excellence, and for inspiration, but all over the country.
Here, here.
It's the beginnings of some probably work on Sweeney. One of the things that I am particularly touched by is the state of just free fall that the country is in, and how that manifests itself in mental health issues, so-called, in people literally breaking down, and in how, as a country, our response to it is so appallingly useless in general. And I was trying to find a myth and a way into writing about this, and I realised that, of course, Sweeney is the great story about what happens when two eras collide and people are caught in the middle, pulled apart between the two. It's not unique to young men, but it seems to me that young men are particularly torn by the situation. And of course, in Sweeney's time, it was the church and the pagan times, the artist on the outside and so on. But it was Sweeney Galt, Mad Sweeney, and Suibhne Galt. And in our time, I think it is perhaps between us and the machine, but the machine in this case being the computer and all that goes with it, the international, well, anyway. This is a more current Sweeney, or with the concept as time goes on. I'll just read a piece of this. It comes on him and ebbs as the power of the goddess rose and fell in Achilles on waves of madness. The severing of mind and magic when power shifts exacts new tributes. He thinks the new regime spreads panic, when the curse worked in him and pin feathered his skin, he did not in his agony put to sea where he is easy, or when he dived into the salt, the blue glass, green glass, clear-eyed wash of it, he didn't stay. He still craves human company. He's back again, perching, ping-shanked in the trees, roosting out on the islands in full flight like a cock pheasant ragged from battle, a splendid aegis. He will fly, his feathers are grey, dragging and tarry from the rubbish tips, the madness in full black fire burning up his nights, the whirligig sky mocking and starry, watching him, eyes red from pain, and the pitiful bare shanks, I know, torment this is tattered man. I know he is afraid of the dank lake he will fly to in the spring, cycling the air wildly to get ahead of what preys on him, and crying hoarse prayers into the wind, into the void, and somehow he has not ended it. Sweeney Agonistes, the beautiful. Sweeney Redivivus, the magnificent old pagan, waiting for a miracle.
Perhaps I'll read a slightly lighter or a different sort of one called Illan, if I had written down the page number, I'd be able to find it. The poem's title is taken from that poem, Illan, as you know, Elbow, from the Illan pipes are called from it. And this is based on a true story.
23.
Thank you very much. Of the old program. Great. Thanks, Pat. For Brian Burke, the painter Brian Burke, who is wonderfully believes life is absolutely absurd, but still great. A bit like myself. And Brian told me the story that's in the book, and I sort of believe him because once myself and Kieran Carson and a load of musicians were travelling across the north. We were in, let's say, a particularly black area, and when they tried to start a session at the end of the night, the people in the hotel, like at 10 o'clock, the people in the hotel came up with the Hoover right up, hoovering under our feet, and so the piper started to tune the pipes to the Hoover. Which was lost on the people in the hotel. This is another kind of piper story. I'm lucky enough to work with musicians a lot. Something you could do worse than you in this life. People sometimes get drunk on the music. One early morning after the night before, not having finished, the story goes that when a baby started crying, his father picked him up, tucked his bellows under his elbow, and started playing him, along with two fiddles, a tin whistle, and the piper who tuned into the baby's cries for the walls of Limerick. When the baby, sick of the noise, stopped, they were halfway through Shoe the Donkey, and seeing that it did no harm, swung into a storm of jigs, the baby squawking, "Saddle the pony." That boy is a slave now to fiddle, harp, melodeon. Somehow in all those tunes he has learned to listen to his own note. He lives on inland water, where sound, whether the listener hears it or not, is magnified and separate, and moves over the air like a sky goat's bleat. He avoids the pipes. He has his reasons. He has heard the story of the octopus who was locked into a room for a week to practice. When they let him out, the pipes had learned to play the octopus. The thing about musicians is they respond to Gloria. There's such a bold audience that I think I'll read you a bit. I think I'll read you a bit of a children's poem.
Woo!
It's called Sparrow, and I won't read it all, but I'll read a bit of it. A poet called Catullus lived in Rome, and he wrote verses on a slate which was waxed. He wrote them with a stylus. They were short and but a bit boring, and in Latin even worse. Catullus wore a toga and brown sandals like a hippie, but he wasn't a big sissy, even though he was a poet. All the Roman men wore dresses to show off their muscly legs and for practicing their yoga. In Rome there also lived a lady, and the lady was so lovely that Catullus said, God help us. He was smitten, which is what you say for struck if you're in love and stuck there. And Lesbia was the lady, beautiful and a bit shady, which the Romans, who were pagans, didn't mind a single bit. Now the lady had a sparrow, and she doted on that bird. Luckily for Catullus, and even luckier for us, who wrote down the songs he sang, it sang her. For a mo, a mass, a mavet, it sang pippi avet. For the sparrow had a stammer, and she loved it very much. Even better than Catullus, who was very, very jealous of the kisses that she gave it. In the end, the sparrow died. Lesbia kicked and screamed and cried. Her face got sad and blotchy, and her eyes got red and ugly. Though Catullus loved her truly, he was glad the bird was dead. The shady lady thumped him in a temper, and she dumped him for a soldier dressed in armour. Instead of fighting for her honour, Catullus wrote more verses, telling all about how saddened he was about his missus, how he missed her hugs and kisses, which made all the schoolboys vomit. I read a couple of new poems. I have to read this because I'm looking at your man there since I came in the horse behind I was thinking actually earlier, I want to just say that yesterday I was in Kerna at a very at a very moving event. It was the launch of a book that I happen to have a couple of translations of, Sios Fagorim, Josie Gorham, and his widow said specifically to give to say thank you to Paul, and I want to remember Josie tonight. And unfortunately I don't have the poem with me that's in the book that does have a title with a couple of words in it that say, O Veil Gabail, O Atgahat, O Sasana, Rosadil, O Shkar the Majin, the Paras Saneha, the Mekshem, Shinsha Koya, Ma Oran, Oran, Saneher. I'm talking about the place. How it remains in song and exists in song. I'm very interested in what happens to place when the people move and the place becomes a tourist. Slogan, like the Wild Atlantic Way, which actually I have a tiny little two-liner about somewhere here, and if I find it, I'll read it. It's a strange phenomenon, is all I can say. But I'll read horse. I love horses, they're all through my work, and I find they come in dreams a lot. That's probably very simply because I was reared at home in Connemara, where I was reared, there were horses everywhere, but wild horses, or not wild, they were owned, but they were, you could be very poor and have a horse. But they come back in dreams at times to rescue me, I find. The black horse stood on the shore. He pawed the ground, galloped down to the high water mark, let out syncopated snorts. He roared. This is my island, who are you? His front hooves looked dangerous. I jumped up and slapped his puss with my gloves 3 times. Whoa! I only speak to white horses. Where are the friendly mares that understand my dreams? Gone, he said. I am the only islander. No more the flesh-eating mares of Diomedes. Terrible, shining, swift, yellow skin. They were my friends. Make do with what it sent, or make nothing. My name is Arion, Demeter's rape child. I turned to go. Get up on my back, I'll carry you. He knelt, I mounted, we went. I climbed down, tired. He cantered back into the tide. So something out of kilter, a skipped drumbeat in his stride made me look back. Then I recognised him by his human feet. Arion, the great horse of the Greeks, with his human feet. The wild Atlantic way, the perils of translation, the trammel mind mistaking nature for wild. Once, this is about home, where I come from. I'm so old that I can remember carnivals. We didn't have many places to do anything. And but every summer they had these wonderful, they had marquees erected. And I still love tents and marquees. They remind me of, there's a circus atmosphere. Actually, I used to go back to those when I was in college even, because I loved the tents. Once it was the roustabout whirl of the Siege of Venice on the marquee floor, the hot night summer carnivals, the fights to be continued New Year, Easter, St. Patrick's Night, young men letting off steam with fists, knives, the Sheehan, the cut and come again, flash of something dangerous, Borges' Vaivén, shining in the light of the disco ball. Women screamed, one fainted in the direction of the knife man. Wise to their tricks, the lads ignored them, hopped and skipped to England, stayed gone until summer. What she remembers is the last dance she got, the night it ended, a slow foxtrot, how the band never stopped, just played louder. Once it was all this, a weekly confession, rehearsed sins, now it's a tourist slogan. And I think two more will suffice. You've been very attentive, so I'll let you off early for good behaviour. This is, this is called Space, Time, Curve. I seem to be writing a lot about time, and I'm fascinated by the whole trying to understand the notion of time and space without a physics degree. Space, time, curve, that's just the name. He was my knife then. There were flashes of steel in the sun. He cut an orange into quarters and handed me one, the blade sweet with juice. That's how it was in the sun. Strawberries for lunch and a swim into life itself. Life tastes of salt and strawberries and the flat lick of steel. Then the sting of a thorn in your heel when time swerves and curls backwards and we're poised at the top of a wave, the girl, the fruit, the man with the knife in his hand. And this last one I read is, I'm doing a series of poems, or I probably am doing a series of poems, on Shakespeare plays, Shakespeare characters, because there are ones I've always wanted to write about, and they're a useful way for me, sort of writing about other things. But I love Shakespeare, and you know, this is as good a way of putting that into action as any. I've been going to workshops for the last, off and on, over the last 2 years, as a way of trying to read all the Shakespearean plays again at this stage in my life. There is, I'm fascinated by, as I said, how history or how place and people survive. I'm not in song and place survives in song, but how history survives in song. I'm also fascinated about how people sort of insist themselves into history despite being absolutely written out of it. And that is perhaps what this is about, really. But on the surface, it's about Kallinga Kasturme from Henry IV, part 1 or 2. Pistol says it when he's saying nonsense language. He says the only words of Irish they're thought to be, and they look more like Latin, in the whole of the Shakespearean canon. I think it's 31 or is it 49? Anyway, mentions of Ireland in the entire Shakespearean canon. And let's say it's 13, let's say it's 39, in which case something like 36 of them are negative. lest we get above ourselves. Naturally enough, because Essex was over in Ireland fighting wars, he was expected to arrive back any minute, absolutely victorious, and he didn't. And he got stuck in the bog, as they said. So the references do not expect to see us reflected well in Shakespeare, who was a politic young chap and had to be very careful about which way the wind was blowing when he was writing his plays. As somebody said to me once, imagine when one king got beheaded and the other fellow moved, imagine how nervous he'd be waiting for those notices if the play had moved the wrong way politically. And so Pistol says, Calen o Custodeme, and depending on who you believe, this is thought to come from, and there's lots and lots of interesting scholarship, if you're interested in that kind of thing, and I am, to read up on this.
What does it mean?
Some of it's silly. It means one of two things. It could either be Calen o Custodeme, which is a very common, young girl of my heart, or young girl, dear young girl, common in songs all over the place, or Calen o Custodeme, I'm a young girl from the banks of the shore. So, both are songs and both have been documented as possible sources that were around at the time. And if you're interested in songs and singing, it's lovely to look back through that particular possibility. So I use that. The other thing to remember is I'm interested in how children learn to talk and what they have before they learn to talk. And you doing psychology will know about canonic and babble, which is the the kids do before, which is a vital part of their development, linguistically and psychologically. What were you doing, a Chailin Og, astray among the maids and trollops, stripped of your diphthongs, so far from home with a war on? Some say our tricky language found purchase in the bard's pen. You were just a stream of gibberish, canonical babble on a fool's tongue. Whether you were the girl from the banks of the river shore or the love of his heart, you slipped into history by the back door, floated in on the line like a lark in London, light as a breath of fresh air among the servants and kings and the what ish my nation talk. Of his Calen Og, Stor, you are still here. Good morning, Margaret.